this is class 4. At your first quiz, it'll give you an idea of the kind of questions that we ask. Question about the website. I had put some Word files there in addition to PDF files, but then at least one of you told me they couldn't load the Word files, so we can change them to all PDFs. I think the only thing now that's only in a Word file is the syllabus. How many of you can't get it if I put a Word file up? Okay, several. So we'll just put PDF files. I did that just so you could be easier for you to add your own things to it. More editable. Also, I had two versions of the syllabus. One of them was done by major topics. It was a little different, but it really was the same thing as the other one. That's not up there anymore. I'm not sure why. We'll try to coordinate the putting things and taking things off the web a little more. About that first writing assignment, you don't have to depend just on lecture and readings we've given you. You can use other sources. It's easy to find important historical figures in the history of neuroscience. And the I like the Encyclopedia Britannica, for example. It's very good in history areas, and they have very good descriptions. In fact, the part about the brain that they had for many years, I'm not sure about the current version, was written by Charles Scott Sherrington, and then it was revised when successive versions of the Britannica came out. Just at the beginning here, I found a couple more pictures of the homunculus that I didn't like those that I found before and showed you in the previous class. This is one from Zygmunt et al., a graduate textbook in neuroscience. This is the homunculus from your own textbook, which isn't meant to show where it is in the cortex, but just to show what is the term we use to show this distortion? Why is there a big hand and other parts of the body are disproportionately small? Why is that? What? I guess I have to call on one of you. It's the amount of cortex devoted in a particular part of the brain, in this case the postcentral gyrus, to that region of the body. Okay, so lips and hands are disproportionately represented. And of course, it's not very accurate. It's just to give you the idea. Okay. So we've now talked about three types of goals of people trying to explain behavior in neurological terms. The goals that have can be found repeatedly in the literature and in the debates in this field, going back to Descartes at least. Today we'll talk about the modern subsystems approach. The first point, though, I'd like to make is that all these diagrams of circuits that we try to do often omit the complexity of the central nervous system ingredients. So we'll talk first about that. Then we'll talk about, we'll take an information flow approach, the way Wernicke's approach that we've already seen Wernicke's diagram based on Wernicke's ideas, and it is the major approach even now among cognitive neuroscientists and other people trying to explain behavior in animals. And that is information flow depicted in engineering type diagrams, and we'll do that for the reflex and then see how that can be elaborated a little bit before we go on to talk about neurons and their properties. So first of all, about the ingredients. These things I've put in red probably are not in your printout. but they will be on the web after the lecture today. So first of all, the connections, we know from anatomical studies, don't always simply go from the stimulus side to the motor side. Okay? For example, there are feedback connections from the motor side to the sensory side. In fact, that's only the beginning of the complexity. When we get to the local level, local circuits, they're much more complex than that. And we'll see a little bit about that when we talk about synapses, either next time or the following lecture. The diagrams often don't even deal with excitation inhibition, and they don't deal with the different rates of change. We know that different neurotransmitters have different rates of action, and that also depends on the receptor molecules that they're binding, these neurotransmitters are binding to. And that is, a lot of that is not, I mean, physiologists deal with unit properties, know about these things, but people explaining behavior, neurological terms, usually don't deal with that very much. Also, another thing that's difficult to deal with in these models are the modulating influence, which are two major types that are difficult to deal with. That is, the diffuse connections, basically the things that cause widespread changes in the brain. The models do not deal readily with those, especially the connectionist models based on stimulus to response side connections. There are diffuse connections. So, for example, there are cells in the hindbrain that have very widely projecting axons. One of them uses norepinephrine or noradrenaline as a transmitter. And even though the number of cells is not big, a few thousand maybe, those axons go everywhere. They even go down into the spinal cord, they go up into the brain, they go up into the neocortex. And some of them, in fact, when they release their transmitter, there's no specific synapse. They release them into the extracellular space. So these, it's an example of a modulating system. And there's other ways that the chemical environment changes. There are shifts in things secreted into the cerebrospinal fluid, which then diffuses into the brain. And we know that these things can profoundly alter the state of the brain and behavior. Okay. And in general, these system-wide shifts in function are not very well understood. Yes, question? No, intercellular, not intracellular. Okay. Between the cells. Okay. There's not very much space between cells, but there is some fluid space. There's a lot more space during development. Okay. But they're still able to diffuse from cell to cell. And the last thing about the ingredients of the nervous system is about nerve cells. This is not indicated in most of these models, but they can be spontaneously active. They can generate a response without any stimulus. Or they can generate responses that are not accounted for at all by the triggering stimulus. Okay. So these are all factors we have to keep in mind when we deal with these attempts to explain behavior, and shows the limit, the problems we have in our connectionist models. Okay, so let's now go through some of these information flow diagrams used to explain behavior. We'll just start with reflexes. Then we'll introduce the idea of gating mechanisms that can be used to explain things like motivation and attention. And we'll give one way we can think about evolution of higher control. Okay, so first of all, the reflex. This is a way to diagram a reflex. You have a stimulus, you have a central nervous system in between, and you have a response. Okay? And we often, behaviorists for a long time have talked about function that way. Anatomists have commonly thought that what they're studying is these pathways between stimulus and response when they're studying the pathways inside this box. I just want to point out here that B.F. Skinner. I wonder if that means we're supposed to. Okay. Do you know who B.F. Skinner was? Behaviorist at Harvard. Invented the idea of a certain kind of conditioning, operant conditioning. Okay. And his attitude was that if we can relate stimulus to response and work out the properties and the plasticity of those connections by our conditioning experiments, and we don't have to open the black box at all. You don't really have to study the nervous system to explain behavior. He thought all you had to do was deal with the stimulus and the response. Okay. That was an extreme view of a certain group of behaviorists. Okay, now what? Let's try to elaborate this model a little bit. We'll begin to separate modules, functional modules. Okay? So, for example, we can separate the sensory analysis and the organizers of motor activity. This way, the stimulus comes in to analyzers, the information is then passed to the motor control mechanisms, different neurons receiving connections from the analyzers, and that they connect then through the motor neurons to the response. Some of the input neurons may have more direct connections to the motor site than others. Okay? And we can apply that to just about any sensory system and still stick with a simple reflex model or straight-through processing model of behavior. If it's easiest in the spinal cord, this could deal with the circuitry in one segment of the spinal cord with input coming through the dorsal root, where it's analyzed and then finally connecting to the motor output. But we could also deal with it with cranial nerves, like the optic nerve coming from the eye. We know about complex analyzing mechanisms in the retina and in the next place where the retina connects in the brain. Okay, and it goes through several stages of processing. That system has been worked out in a lot of detail to the visual cortex and beyond. And similarly, we know various systems that process motor control not only at the level of the spinal cord, but higher up. We can't get too far without talking about some intervening mechanisms. So I've introduced that here. I've labeled it I, intermediate networks, that control the action patterns. Now, these, of course, occur at more than one level, but this would apply just even to one segment of the spinal cord. You really need that additional mechanism. That is, you can separate functional modules, even at a single segment of the spinal cord. And this just indicates that there are some complexity in the connections. Some connections from the input side are more direct to the motor side, as I mentioned before, but there are also connections from these intervening networks that go in both directions, not only to the motor side, but back to the sensory side. Okay, so we're just starting to introduce a few complexities there. Now, this model is sufficient to explain or deal with and talk about natural behavior patterns, inherited behavior patterns studied by zoologists, the people we call ethologists. They and also people that study the physiologists that study human behavior will use these thresholds, especially these first three. Talk about the adequate stimulus. That means that to trigger a certain behavior, certain configurations of stimuli are adequate to trigger it. Others are not. And even when you have an adequate stimulus, it has to reach a certain threshold. It has to be of a certain intensity before it will trigger the behavior. Okay. The idea of command neuron is used by neuroethologists to talk about certain neurons in this intermediate network. which when stimulated artificially will trigger, just by stimulating that one neuron, will trigger a whole pattern of behavior. Okay. The fixed action patterns is a name, the FAP. It's a little bit misleading because it says fixed. It's fixed in the sense that the same behavior pattern is seen in all members of a given species. Humans have many of them. Smiling, for example, is a fixed action pattern. It's also sometimes called an instinct. These are inherited movement patterns. Okay? Walking, what I'm doing right now, is an inherited pattern. I do it almost the same as you do, but then it has some individual characteristics, too, that have been shaped by learning. Okay? In other words, the kinds of reflexes that control these pathways, that control these instinctive behavior patterns, have some plasticity. Okay? We also call it learning, but learning can be of various sorts. So the more general term, especially when we're talking about nervous system connections, is plasticity. So we can shape the behavior patterns. And almost all fixed action patterns in almost any species can be shaped to some degree, although some of them are remarkably fixed from one animal, one member of the species to others. Others show more variability, but almost all of them can be shaped to some degree. Okay. So I'm just introducing a few concepts from both behavioral science and neuroethology because they're useful when we talk about neurological control of behavior. Okay, so now, beyond that model, what more does the brain do? Let's talk about these concepts. The higher reflex arc. So we're not dealing with a model that applies just to one segment of the spinal cord, but we start to indicate in our model multiple levels of the nervous system. Then we'll talk about gating mechanisms and how we can invent using these diagrams a simple model of motivation or of attention. And then we'll talk a little bit about the evolution of higher control. Okay, so here's what I've done to this model. Indicate the hierarchy of reflexes. I've gone back to the simplest diagram of the reflex here because I'm trying to convey a different thing here. I'm just indicating that a stimulus that's coming in, say, to the spinal cord not only passes fairly directly through to the response side, but it also gives rise to connections to other levels of the nervous system. Many of these go into the brain, for example. And then there are connections at those higher levels that can go through the intervening pathways and affect the very same response. Okay? So when I step here and I have a extension movement of my foot, okay, a lot of that is spinal in its control. But I can stop and control it. I can stop and start it. I have voluntary control of it. And for that, I need these higher pathways. Okay, I need pathways involving at least the motor cortex, the corpus striatum, parts of the forebrain. Okay. So that is an elaboration of that connectionist model. So now let's talk a little bit about the gating mechanisms. I just want to get you thinking in terms of this kind of model. These are very common in current studies, both in cognitive neuroscience and other parts of the field of physiological psychology. So, for example, we can deal with attention. We can put our model here of behavior, the reflex model of behavior, and then we can say we have a higher structure, this may be in the brain somewhere, that's getting separate inputs and that influences by its connection these pathways. So the arrow here could be in excitatory connections, these could be inhibitory connections. So we can shape the way information is flowing from stimulus to response at one level of the nervous system by something going on at another level. Okay? It's a kind of gating, and we can use it to explain attention. We can enhance, for example, the input, one type of input. and not others. Okay? The same, very same kind of thing can be used for motivational effects. For example, let's say this is a pathway controlling mouth opening. Okay. And this is a mechanism where there are neurons that are more active when there's a need for energy resources. In other words, we're hungry. Okay. That mechanism gets some input indicating the state of the body's need for energy resources, and it can then influence the reflexes for mouth opening. An animal, like if you have a cat, okay, if it's very hungry, you can trigger by touching its lips, mouth opening much more easily than if it's not hungry. It's real easy to see in a human infant. Okay? When the infant is hungry, you simply brush its cheek, and what does it do? It turns and opens its mouth looking for the nipple. It's called the rooting reflex. Okay? Well, that reflex changes in sensitivity and threshold very much with the state of hunger. And all you need to explain it is simple reflex pathways from stimulus to response that are gated. Okay? And that then could represent changing hunger level. So it's a very simple model of motivation. Right? So now let me just give you one way to think about higher control. Now this is a little complicated, but let me try to explain this diagram. All right? Here's our model with sensory analyzers, intervening mechanisms, and a motor system. Now, I've labeled this C because what I'm having the higher systems do is I'm having them compare. I'm having this mechanism compare what's coming from the higher system and what's coming through the reflex pathways. So, for example, if this one is inhibitory and this one is excitatory, this one could cancel that one out if the timing and intensity were just right. Okay, so what is going on that could do that? Well, this could be a system containing the images and plans from our memory that represent a model of the world. So I'm trying to think about how higher function, what higher function at its highest levels is in our brains. And what I see in very general terms is the posterior half of the neocortex is concerned with images. These are the sensory mechanisms of the posterior part of our cortex, and we'll see that when we study the different sensory systems. We have not just sensory analyzers, but representations of objects, okay, and memories of those things. We can trigger them by electrical stimulation of certain parts. We say that the higher areas of the posterior cortex. Okay, we can trigger memories. Okay, they're activated in our dreams. In fact, they're exquisitely detailed. Some of us, like Cajal, can shut their eyes and see these images. I would like to invent a little test. I'm working with a fellow on this because I can do this. And I find that many people can't. The ability varies a lot. We don't understand it very well. So I'm going to get him to give me a little test that we can give all of you. And we'll see if we can pick out some of the variability in it. You can play with it a little bit yourself. But the idea is this. If I look at this object here and stare at it, and shut my eyes, I still see the object. Now, I don't just remember what the object's like. I actually see it. Okay? And then I can keep my eyes shut and turn it, and I see it turn. But when I see things turn, it depends on the properties that I'm looking at. This is one of the things we're studying. And it apparently varies with the part of the brain that's representing that. So you can start to test yourself and let me know, but we'll invent a test and we'll give it to you and we'll get feedback from you. And nothing won't affect your grade. But This is just another example of the kind of evidence we have, these elaborate images. Okay. The brain does more than that. On the motor side, the anterior part of the brain, remember we talked about the motor cortex and the frontal cortex just in front of the central fissure, where we know we can stimulate and trigger movements. Well, if you go a little forward there, we're in parts of the brain that are a little more distant from the immediate triggering of movement. They represent immediate and more distant plans for movement. Okay? And what's more, as this system develops, and the system that does this becomes a huge part of our neocortex. Neocortex represents about 80% of the human brain. Okay, and the parts that deal with images and plans are most of that. Okay. They're also highly interconnected with the more posterior parts, so they're affecting these images. Okay, so if now what that's doing is predicting the world, it could shape the system. If the comparison stops the input here, the reflex pathway will not control behavior. Behavior will be controlled by this higher mechanism. If the higher mechanism, though, fails to predict what's going to happen, then the reflex takes over. And there's good evidence that that happens. I have some direct evidence for it in the hamsters I studied. But it's not something that we've found easy to get a handle on. Professor Beatsy, who studies motor control, has in the last couple of years been thinking more about this type of problem. But it's very difficult for an experimenter to get at. So anyway, just to trigger your thinking a little bit, if we could elaborate this and explain and we and understand it more, we could do a lot more to explain behavior. So now let me just introduce to you the next things. I've not given you the printout here yet, but we'll give it to you next time and we'll post it on the web. Let me just get it introduced. These are our next topics. And this will take up quite a bit of time here in the early part of the class, particularly when we get to an introduction to neuroanatomy, which is an aspect of this class which your textbook does not do a very good job at. And most classes in this don't do much, but I do quite a bit because I find it's really valuable for further study in neuroscience. In fact, we teach a second course just on that, second term, 914. But in this class, we'll start now talking about what I call primitive cellular mechanisms and how they're expressed in single neurons. These are mechanisms that they're basically properties of single-cell organisms, but they become more specialized in the nervous system. So we'll talk about that first, and then we'll talk about the evolution of multicellular organisms, and I'll give you some ideas about brain evolution based on phylogenetic comparisons, widely different species. And then we'll give you our schematic outline of connections in vertebrate brains. We won't talk much about invertebrate brains in the class. We'll talk about vertebrates in general. We won't be talking only about human. In fact, the human brain, because the human brain is a very distorted brain. It's become distorted because certain parts have become so huge, we tend to neglect the parts, some very critical parts, that are relatively smaller. So I don't use the human brain primarily, though your textbook will do that. Okay. When you're in medical school, the human brain will be thrown at you in all its complexity, and you will be taught it without learning the logic of the connections. I will stress the logic of the connections and how they evolved. Okay. These are the primitive cellular mechanisms we'll be dealing with. Irritability and conduction. Irritability means a response to some kind of stimulus of a single cell. Cells are irritable. When you touch their membrane, you cause a depolarization of the membrane, and that depolarization is conducted to other parts of the cell. So that's what we'll talk about first. Movement in cells is mainly a property of muscle cells, but it does occur in neurons too. Primarily, there's some movement even in the adult brain, but most of it's during development. So when we get beyond these topics, and we talk about anatomy, we'll also have one section on brain development. Then we'll talk about secretion by neurons. Neurons are secreting cells. It's not only our endocrine cells that do that, but the main secretion is at the synapse. Then we'll talk about sensory specializations for irritability. And finally, the endogenous activity, the spontaneous activity of neurons, which I mentioned before. We won't spend any more time on this, but most of this will be deferred, but mechanical contraction is the first aspect of movement. These occur during development of neurons. Migration of cells, after they've been born in the cell, they grow processes which involves movement of parts of the cell. When the cell is injured, there's some regenerative changes which also involve movement. But it's becoming a topic, these developmental topics are becoming now much more well-known to non-developmental neuroscientists because of the amount of plasticity, not only in developing, but also adult brains. There are morphological changes in our brains when we learn things, and that's becoming more and more recognized. These are the terms we use when we talk about irritability and conduction. And you should now be reading in your textbook chapter on neuron properties to learn basic cell properties and physiological properties of the nervous system. Learn about how membranes of cells are polarized. What do we mean by polarization of the membrane? We mean it has an electrical potential across the membrane. And when that potential will respond to stimuli and change, generally the response is depolarization. But there are chemical effects that can cause it to become hyperpolarized. If it's depolarized in one little part of the cell, it will be conducted in a graded way, meaning that it becomes less and less the further you get from the source. That's decremental conduction. But we can also get triggering of an action potential, which is just in one part of the cell, the axon. Okay, and that's something the nervous system is specialized for. Okay, it's not shown in most cells in, say, plant cells, which also show membrane polarization. They show graded responses, but generally they don't show action potentials. And its action potentials are conducted non-decrementally. Okay, and then we'll talk about chemical and electrical properties at the synapse. Okay, this will be the last slide for today. I want to describe cells in terms of certain of the major morphological types. These are certainly not the only types. You don't see the pyramidal cell here. You don't see the stellate cell, the neocortex that I mentioned before. But these are ones that are easiest to talk about in terms of these properties, particularly the properties of axons. The multipolar neuron, bipolar neuron, and monopolar neuron. The monopolar neuron here is the type of cell that has its axon coming in through the dorsal root. Okay? Where are the dendrites of those cells? They protrude from the beginning of the axon, and they're out in the periphery. For example, in your hand. Okay? You have free nerving endings in the hand. You have other nerve fibers like this that terminate in little specialized organs that enhance the sensitivity to heat and cold and mechanical pressure. Okay, that's the dendritic portion of the cell. Dendrite simply means branch, the branches, okay, like the branches of a tree. Okay, and then this is the axon, where you specialize for rapid conduction. And in the case of the dorsal root cell, the cell body simply is off to the side in the dorsal root ganglion, which is near the spinal cord, but it's still outside the spinal cord. And then the axon comes into the spinal cord, and it has these end branches, the axon terminals. We also call them axon telodendria. You don't have to write it down. It'll be in later notes. Okay. We also have bipolar cells, which are very similar, except the cell is not off to the side like this. There are cells like this in our auditory system and our vestibular system. The dendrites are, for example, in the auditory system, are in the cochlea, in the inner ear, and they're responding to pressure changes that are conducted into the cochlea through the middle ear from pressure changes in the air, and vibration of the eardrum. And then the action potential starts there, jumps over the cell body, and goes into the central nervous system, into the axon endings. The little swellings there at the end of axons are called the boutons terminal. That's the French name, but we use it in English, call them boutons. It means end buttons. Okay, bouton, terminal, the end buttons, little swellings. They're not always at the end like that. They can be along the way. We call those boutons en passant. Okay, boutons in passage. Okay, and then here's this would be typical of a motor neuron, a neuron that sends its axon out of the central nervous system to an effector organ, like a muscle. Okay. And the dendrites would be in the ventral part of the spinal cord, the ventral horn. The axon would come out the ventral root, okay, conduct rapidly to the terminals, which in the case of a motor neuron would be on striated muscle. Okay. Now there are smooth muscles that get innervated also, mostly by the autonomic nervous system, where this cell is not in the CNS, it's in a peripheral ganglion. And we'll be learning that anatomy before too long in the class. All right, that's enough for today. I'll give you the printout of this at the beginning of the next class, and it will be posted on the web.